in the midst of a third surge here in Orange County. And we thought it was important to gather together many of the experts that our newsroom have been working with over the last few months and kind of just ask everybody's basic questions about trying to put this latest surge into perspective. Is it leveling off? Given that it's a big reopening, should we have expected this many cases to come out? And, you know, what does it mean for big venues? Right now, we've got, you know, 45,000 people a day going through the Orange County Fairs. So the big question, again, for us is just how do we move forward with this latest surge? Our beat reporter, as always, Spencer Custodio, has been assembling just a really impressive array of local experts. I think that's the biggest difference about our newsroom here is that we will give you coronavirus information that is specific to every corner of Orange County. Spencer, you want to talk a little bit about the great panel that we've got to join us today?
Yeah, sure. And I just want to thank everybody for joining us. We have Orange County Deputy Health Officer, Dr. Regina Chinzio Kwan. Most people will know her as Dr. CK. We're also joined by Sang-Hyuk Shin. He's a UC Irvine epidemiologist and public health expert. Along with him is Vladimir Minin, a UCI biostatistician who's worked very closely to track the trends throughout Orange County. Most recently found that the coastal cities were spiking. We also have Melissa Don Pinto. She's a nursing professor at UCI and an expert on long-term COVID symptoms. And we have Dr. Jim Keeney, the co-director of the emergency department at Providence Mission Hospital in Mission Viejo and the former hospital chief of staff.
Awesome. I mean, again, thanks to everybody that's taken the time out to be here. These are always kind of like tough questions. Regina, we figured we'd start with you to just kind of get a general sense of where we're at this time around, you know, on the coronavirus. And again, we really appreciate your work at the Orange County Healthcare Agency and appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to join us today.
Thank you for inviting and thank you for organizing this. Well, unfortunately, as you probably all have heard, we have a higher number of cases than last week. At this rate, we're averaging about 750 new cases a day, whereas last week we were in the 500s. We were hoping that we would avoid some of this, but in terms of what we were expecting after we've got a lot of people vaccinated, I don't know that we really had a number in mind of what to expect. I think Delta really changed everything. As we know, Delta is more transmissible, more easily spread. And there's just so many more in our community that need to be vaccinated. What we did see with this surge is that our coastal communities, just like you said, were the ones who had the higher case rates, you know, as soon as we started opening up. And there's a lot of conclusions you can come out with that. It could just be human behavior. And, you know, after June 15th, everybody wanted to go out to the beach. I don't know. I can't, you know, give you a specific. What we do know is that there's areas that were highly vaccinated that have low rates of transmission. Example, Laguna Woods did an amazing job with getting their community vaccinated, and there's many others. Didn't always correlate, but for the most part, when we had a lot more of the elderly population vaccinated, what we did see is when cases start to pop up, it was more likely in the unvaccinated and the younger population.
And what is your sense? Recently, we did a story about the ambulance diversions beginning to spike a bit. Supervisor Katrina Foley did do an update this early this afternoon. We were able to hear from Dr. Carl Schultz, the EMS director here for Orange County. And can you speak a little bit about that? Because when people hear ambulances are being diverted, that's somewhat concerning. But to hear Schultz talk about it, it's like, if you've got a heart attack, you're still going to be dealt with despite whatever kind of surge that we're in. I just thought it was important for people to get a sense of what's happening at the emergency rooms.
Well, in general, that message was put out because, you know, our department looks at how long it's taking for patients to get into the hospitals. And when we see even a slight increase, we have to keep an eye on it. And it could be from many factors, right? It could be COVID. It could be, you know, maybe there's some other incidents going on. More naturally, it's going to be there's more people getting hospitalized and going to the ER for COVID. We know that. And what we're just trying to tell hospitals, especially those with ERs, is do the best that they can to not divert and take care of those patients, because you know all the other hospitals are experiencing this as well. What's different this time around compared to last year is that already last year, hospitals were already changing their how they're taking care of patients because they're making space for all of COVID. Remember, we had to divert every elective surgery. This time around, we want hospitals to be fully functional to take care of those daily things that people come into the hospital for. We don't want to reduce that, but you know, if the COVID rates continue to rise, we're going to start seeing that more and more hospitals will be affected and that ambulance times may increase.
Thank you again.
Christina, I mean, I can tell you, I can echo what Christina said, is that it's an all-time, you know, high of what's coming in since the peak in January, February. But we did in those times cancel elective surgeries and do a lot of maneuvers to empty out the hospital from anyone that was elective or semi-elective. And we're trying not to do that. That really created a backlog and it created a lot of suffering from people whose surgeries weren't necessarily emergency, but they were needed and necessary. And so it all backs up in the emergency room. When you don't have enough beds in the hospital, then people sit in the emergency room. Currently, when I look at our tracker, last time I looked, we have about 8 or 9 people just sitting there waiting for a bed upstairs because there are no beds upstairs. And so we still are, you know, it's hard to get additional staff because every hospital in the country is looking for additional staff. So, you know, we do have traveling nurses and other ways to expand our staff, but it doesn't happen overnight. Even our most recent hires, you know, it takes minimum 30 to 60 days to get somebody here and on staff.
Wow. I think today Dr. Schultz was telling us that both South County and the hospitals on the border of LA County seem to be the most impacted by this recent surge. Is that what you found or what you're hearing?
Well, I mean, for our hospital, for sure. I mean, we are heavily impacted. There's patients waiting, you know, just unacceptable lengths of stay waiting in the waiting room. The person that I admitted earlier today at about 2 o'clock, and that's after, you know, being here, getting assessed, and then deciding he needs to stay in the hospital. He's still in the waiting room waiting for a room upstairs. And it's here it is 5 hours later. So, you know, it's just this is why we're trying to get the message out for everyone who can get vaccinated to get vaccinated, because you may say your risk is small. You may say, oh, you know, I'm willing to take the risk. But what you're doing is putting yourself in a position to need our help when we may not be available to give it. Also, you're not creating the barriers to spread. And so rather than it stopping with you, or maybe just being spread to 1 or 2 really close heavy contacts because you've been vaccinated, you are continuing to spread it, especially with this Delta virus, which is highly contagious, much more contagious than the other ones. And it's just running through communities at this point.
Spencer, let's go to my next point. Yeah, Vladimir, he's been tracking the local trends, you know, which cities, which zip codes are kind of taking off. And the last time we had chatted, he had found that, you know, coastal Orange County, for whatever reason, you know, is spiking a lot faster than the rest of the county. So I kind of want to get an update from Vladimir on that front. Kind of where do we sit? Where's the Delta virus really hitting Orange County? Is it still the coastal areas? Or at this point, is it kind of just increasing everywhere throughout the county?
Yeah, good question, Spencer. I just updated the numbers today and posted them on our little dashboard that we are running here at UCI. So the situation is changing a little bit. So it's kind of interesting. It's changing a little bit in some small number of places, a little bit for the better. So for example, I'll start with the good news. So for example, the Newport Beach and Laguna are kind of plateauing right now and has been for, this is the second week I'm seeing it. The first week I thought maybe that's a fluke, but this is the second week in a row that they're not decreasing, but they're not increasing anymore. The bad news is Huntington Beach has broken through the 10% positivity today. During my update, not today, maybe last week probably. So right now it's the highest sort of surging city that we're tracking. Not too far behind Huntington Beach are Costa Mesa, Dana Point, San Clemente, and Mission Viejo. All of these four are very close to 10% positivity, but not have quite broken that unfortunate record yet, but very close. I would say northern OC, as we have seen before, is surging but slower. So the increase is there, but it's markedly more gradual compared to the southern and coastal OC.
Got it. Now, is there a correlation between, like, say, Huntington Beach, Costa Mesa, Daniel Point, some of these cities that are surging ahead of the rest of Orange County? Do they have lower vaccination rates, do you know, compared to, say, you know, Anaheim Hills or Garden Grove or something like that?
You know, it's a great question, and I probably let Regina answer, because the data that kind of I have access to is public and not very good, to be honest. So I would rather have Regina get to that. Yep.
Yes, definitely. Thank you. So San Clemente, Newport Beach, Huntington, and Costa Mesa were really, you know, the areas that we had the lowest vaccination rates going into June. You know, Garden Grove, Santa Ana, actually, and Anaheim, you know, we targeted so much with vaccination efforts, and actually, I think all those efforts paid off because when we saw some of these rises in cases, they actually were not in those areas. But you know, I think, again, it's more the coastal areas and the ones that have the lowest vaccination rates.
And Sanyu, do you want to talk a little bit about this Delta variant? Like, again, what is it that's making this one spread so fast? Is it a combination of the virality of or the spread of the makeup of the virus, or just that we opened up so quickly?
Yeah, no, good question. And I think it's a mixture of both. So, you know, as mentioned before, it does appear to be much more contagious than sort of the previous variants that we've seen. So, you know, what we think is that in general, when the original COVID-19, you know, virus hit, that, you know, when one person gets COVID-19, on average, maybe two or three people will get infected as well. So it will spread to two or three people. But with the Delta variant, it appears to be maybe about two times more infectious, so more transmissible. So if on average, if one person gets infected, maybe it will spread to six, seven, perhaps even eight more people. So it does appear to be a lot more transmissible. We don't really know precisely what the biology behind that is, you know, why that is occurring. There's some suggestion that there appears to be, you know, much more of the virus in the nasal area, and therefore, you know, it's more transmissible. And so, you know, for example, if for the previous, you know, variants that we've seen, it was believed that, you know, most transmission occurred when there was prolonged exposure to somebody who's infected, so 15 minutes or more. But now it appears that transmission can often happen as much, even from kind of more brief contact, because presumably there's more virus kind of being expelled into the surrounding environment. The good news is that the vaccines still seem to be very efficacious, so very effective. So especially for, you know, severe cases and for death, we're still seeing around 95% effectiveness of the mRNA vaccines, for example, on the Delta variant. And, you know, the one thing that we're learning more and more is that when there are breakthrough infections that occur among people who are vaccinated, it does appear that they are able to you know, spread the virus as well. So, you know, the good news is breakthrough infections are relatively rare, but when they do occur, it can potentially lead to further spread. So, you know, those, again, it's kind of something that we're learning more about as more research is being conducted, and as we, you know, have more of the Delta, unfortunately, spreading in our communities. But, you know, those are some of what has been studied and what is known at the moment.
Sanyu, given what you're seeing about this Delta variant, what's your sense of venues like the fair opening up and large scale opening up? Do you have a sense of that, or medically, where does that come from? And maybe Regina, you can speak to this as well, as to why are certain things allowed if it's this viral?
Yeah, I think I'll let Regina speak to why things are allowed, but I guess from a public health perspective, no, I don't think it's a good idea for large gatherings to occur right now. Even outdoor settings, what we know is when there are huge outdoor events, people tend to gather together and then go out and have meals that are often indoors and go to bars. And so even with outdoor events, we've had a number of huge clusters that have been associated with them. And so I think in general, these big gatherings are not a good idea right now, given the community level transmission that's going on.
Yes, I could definitely speak to that. I think, we were all excited around June and we were doing such a great job getting people vaccinated. We're getting closer to our goal of at least getting 70% of the adult population vaccinated before July 4th. And everybody was just tired. Everybody's tired of having to be at home, and we're excited to look forward to something. And at the time, while we, in the scientific field, and Dr. Shin was looking so closely at Delta, and so was I, more of the discussion was around Alpha and the previous variants, which were not as contagious. And so with that information, and with, our understanding that people were going to get vaccinated, we felt, California felt, that it was okay to have these big events, and that as long as everybody planned appropriately, from the learnings of the previous COVID variants, we can safely get through summer and allow for some relaxation of the restrictions. Of course, COVID, Delta just changed everything. And we, response time may not have been as quick, right, to respond to the contagiousness of it. I have to agree, it's not a good idea to go to very crowded areas, even small gatherings. You really have to be careful, even if everyone is fully vaccinated, because just as Dr. Shin said, if someone is vaccinated actually is carrying COVID and they don't have symptoms, they can potentially spread it to someone else. And many of us have young kids like myself who are not yet vaccinated, or who have loved ones who are not vaccinated yet, or who they themselves are at risk, or they have an immunocompromised loved one at home who may have gotten vaccinated, but we know already from the studies may not mount a good immune response. So there's many people that are surround us who are at risk. And this is where it becomes very risky to go to a large event or to socialize and even small gatherings without a mask. This is where everything we learned from the past actually works. Wearing a mask is yet another barrier to protect yourself or others from transmitting viral particles. We saw lower flu rates this winter because of the use of masks. So I know that there's a lot of question of whether masks work. They do, they're another form of barrier. We know that distancing works. When we look at all the contacts or the outbreaks that happened in the community as well as in schools, it was in the areas where people were not appropriately distancing or using the mask where we saw the outbreak. When schools actually followed all the mitigation recommendations, we didn't have an outbreak. And so all these things that we've learned, we can put into practice to say, continue to protect ourselves with Delta.
Regina, I was going to say, I hear a lot of people saying, well, I mean, the science shows that masks don't work for coronavirus, or, because it's an aerosolized thing, aerosolized virus. And I got to say that March of 2020, that made sense to me. I thought, oh boy, I don't think masks are really going to work. This is aerosolized. And, aerosol is like cigarette smoke. If you can smell it, and you can from 20, 30, 40 feet away, that same aerosol is traveling with the virus. But since March 2020, we've learned that masks, if we follow the evidence, masks actually do reduce, the spread of this. So while people are trying to quote science out of context and say, I don't need to wear a mask, I mean, why would you not take, the precaution that you can take is my answer. I mean, it's a reasonable precaution. It's something we in the hospital do every day for 8-12 hour time periods. You need to go shopping. You need to, go out, and even if you're going to go out and have fun, I mean, if you're going to be in a crowd, why not wear a mask? Same thing with social distancing. It just seems reasonable, to take the appropriate precautions, even if you're young. A lot, again, it's the young, healthy people who say, well, I don't need to do this. Even if I get it, I'll be fine. But they are the ones that we're finding are perpetuating a lot of the spread. And like you said, loved ones, elderly, people who can't get the vaccine for various medical conditions or age-related issues, they're putting those people at risk.
Now, quick question. Go ahead, Daniel.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to add that I think we can't forget that even with younger people who are at less risk, at lower risk of getting severe disease, that many of them, you know, what we're seeing is a lot of the long COVID, the chronic illness. So I just wanted to kind of, you know, maybe throw that question out to Dr. Pinto and, you know, kind of, you know, what is currently known about, and I think we're seeing all these infections. And I think a lot of young people have this kind of sense of security that they're going to be okay. And so what are you seeing in that research?
Thank you, Great Dr. Sin. Yes. So I think there's been a lot of focus on saving lives, which there should be in the middle of the pandemic. But now we have a vaccine. You take the vaccine, you're less likely to have severe disease that's going to kill you. What people forget is that you can have long haul, and long haul can be very disabling. In our own research, we found that more than 30% of people, when the time they were tested, they were asymptomatic and they went on to develop long haul. We're not quite sure how long, what are the risk factors? It seems to be women in 30s, 40s, 50s, but that doesn't necessarily mean that is the only people that is getting this, but this is a constellation of symptoms. There are now over 200 symptoms identified of long haul, and they last a long time. The most recent international study that I found, 90% of people had on average 55 symptoms, and this was extending beyond 7 months. The problem with this is not just like a little bit of fatigue. This is not chronic fatigue syndrome. This is not ME. This is profound fatigue, chest pain, rashes, bruises, inability to think, brain fog, problems with cognition. So these are relatively healthy people that have now been put down because of long haul. We don't know how long it lasts. We know some people were infected as early as December 2019, and when the virus was here and we didn't know, and some still have unresolved symptoms. So I want people to begin to kind of shift their thinking, because even if you're vaccinated, we still don't know if you're going to develop long haul. You're more than likely going to survive, but you may get long haul, and it does affect the rest of your life. There are people that cannot work because they have long haul, and it is a disability. So I just really encourage people to begin to think about not only just survival and not only mitigation strategies to prevent spread of others, including children, elderly, and those that are immunosuppressed, but also thinking about let's lessen the consequences of long haul. And every time that this virus replicates, we have a chance of getting another variant. And if we get another variant, it's not going to be weaker. It's going to be stronger if it's pervasive throughout the community. And we need to hope that this variant doesn't change so much to where the vaccine doesn't work. So I really, really, really encourage people to get vaccinated.
Now, a quick question too on a mask mandate. And I'm just going to start putting questions in here that we've been getting from the public and that we're continuing to get now through the stream. So we've gotten this question a couple of times, mask mandate. It sounds like, you know, Regina, all of the doctors are telling us you should be wearing a mask, but it's not mandated. Do we look to go towards that direction? Is that more of a political decision as opposed to a medical one? What's the general thinking inside the government on that?
We're just closely following, and we're wanting to follow, you know, what the rest of the state is following. And right now, California Department of Public Health, yes, is putting it back on the local health jurisdictions to make their decisions on how to do this. And, you know, what we want people to remember is that our number one protection right now is vaccination. So we really want the public to focus on that, because that's the one good thing that has been, you know, we've got lots of data suggesting that this is the one thing everyone can do who is eligible. Masking, we're gonna say, you know, all the other mitigation strategies that we've learned in the past, definitely all of us should do that. We just didn't wanna penalize those who were already doing the right things. But again, we're still looking at it closely. Is there a possibility in the future? there's a possibility, but I think we're looking at, you know, how the hospitals are doing, how the staffing is at the hospital, how Delta is or other variants. If there's other variants that are really, really strong and, you know, overcome our vaccine, and then we'll have to rethink our messaging. But for now, again, we want people to focus on vaccination efforts.
A quick question that I got, a question from the audience. What percentage of Orange County residents are currently vaccinated? And will the county start posting daily COVID number updates like they were last year?
Yeah, sure. So the total, when you look at the total population of Orange County, about 64% are now vaccinated. When you're looking at the eligible population, we're at 74.7%. And then adult only population, which is 18 and over, 76.3%. And then 65 and older is 91%. So we're really moving up. But when we think about herd immunity, the real term of herd immunity, we really need a higher vaccination rate for the overall population. So that's the entire population. So 64% is still shy of our bare minimum that we want to reach, which is 70%. So we still have a ways to go to protect more people.
I guess here's one leftover question I just got, which is, if Delta changed everything, then why has nothing changed with how we're approaching things? Why is the fair still open? Why no mask mandate? And I guess that's just a question. We're hearing alarm bells from officialdom, but at the same time, we see kind of basically just go back to business, no more updates, no more daily updates being it. So I guess I'm just curious, and I know you're not a politician, you're not the elected leader of Orange County, you're the Deputy Public Health Director, but as far as you can answer, that'd be great.
I know that we've been discussing with the Board of Supervisors to identify how to go through this. And I know other counties have been looking at specific markers on when they would mandate. It's a careful discussion that has to take place. So, I mean, that's the best that I can do right now. We've been looking at the numbers with the Board of Supervisors, and we'll continue to maintain contact and communication. And Dr. Chow, myself, and Dr. Zahn have been really looking at all of the science and the data to help with that decision.
I just add a comment regarding the herd immunity threshold. I know we've been kind of targeting the 70% threshold, but that was calculated before the advent of the Delta variant. And with the increased transmissibility that Delta variant poses, that 70% is not likely to be sufficient. It's going to be much higher. We don't know exactly what that number is. It may not even be achievable. So I think that's one thing to keep in mind, is that, you know, a lot of what we've been planning and thinking about what was sort of pre-Delta, and so it may or may not be exactly applicable. Although, you know, the same as Regina mentioned, the same evidence-based methods, masking, social distancing, ventilation, and of course vaccines. These are all still the tools that we have, and we know that them to be effective. We just need to make sure that we use more of those tools.
Jim, I get a lot of questions from readers, who's being hospitalized? You know, is it still some of the older folks? Is it kind of, the younger folks, the 20 to 40s? So just kind of on your end, on the front line, who you're seeing coming through the emergency room and into the ICUs?
Yeah, again, I don't know if it tells the whole picture, but it is still the older you are, the higher risk you are. The more body mass you have, the higher risk you are. So the risk factors definitely seem to be playing into who gets admitted to the hospital. But the one biggest, by far, overwhelming kind of elephant in the room is unvaccinated. At this point, I just saw my first vaccinated person that we have to admit to the hospital today. And we don't really know that we're admitting him for COVID. He happened to test positive. We may be admitting him for another medical problem that we're still trying to sort out at this point. Literally, this is hot off the press kind of thing. So that's my first one. Of all the other people we've admitted here anyway, and in my experience, it's been nearly 100% are unvaccinated. So essentially, we're just not seeing vaccinated people have to come to the hospital. Even even the people that are coming that don't need to be admitted to the hospital and aren't that sick, most of them that raise to that level of needing to come to an ER are unvaccinated. A few vaccinated that we then send home because they're doing great, but That's the biggest by far. I mean, that anybody gets the message, that's it. I mean, vaccine will stop you from having to come see me.
What do you find that people tell you, Jim, when they show up? Do you get regret? Do you get, I didn't know, I didn't want to do. I'm just kind of curious, without being too personal, what yeah. kind of feedback are you hearing from those people?
Well, I mean, I think that people get that our message is to be vaccinated. They know that doctors stand united for the most part. There's a few kind of what I would consider, you know, fringe educated doctors that are saying the vaccine is not a good idea, plandemic type of people. But there are the doctors are standing arm in arm saying vaccine is the answer. And so people know that when they come and see me, once they see the white lab coat, they kind of put their guard up. They're not being 100% forthcoming with me and wanting to have some debate about whether they made the right decision or not. And I mean, up until probably today, I'm starting to lose it today, to be totally honest. It's really getting very hard to see these patients and see this as a repetitive problem and not say something. But I feel like it's the wrong time when somebody's struggling for breath and being admitted to the hospital to kind of wag your finger and say, you know, I told you so. So I try not to do that. I think they understand, though, that's what got them here. I don't know if they believe it or not. And everyone has their own reasons for making the decision. Unfortunately, before you're sick, most people listen more to their neighbors, the internet, their pastors, their trusted advisors. It's not until they get sick that they're really interested, in my opinion, at least in that population.
Thanks. And, Melissa had mentioned some of these long hauler symptoms. Sorry about that. And I just wanted to kind of revisit that. You know, Melissa, have you seen any research or any cases in children, especially, you know, children younger than 12? They don't qualify for the vaccines. I know a lot of parents are kind of worried sending their, you know, kids back to school. I think a lot of school districts come back next week for, you know, they've reopened their classrooms. So is there any kind of movement on that front? And has Delta really pushed some of the long hauler symptoms into high gear? Is it creating more? And is it affecting some of the kids on that?
So the thing about it is, with long haul, sometimes people, they'll get sick or they won't even have that, what we call severe of an infection, that sends them to the hospital. It's not until months later that they start to develop long haul. And sometimes these symptoms are not the same sort of symptoms that they had when they were acutely ill. So it's a little too early for us to know, but I do want to give you the American Academy of Pediatrics guidelines for kids back to school. So they are recommending masking, social distancing, and I know sometimes that is a challenge, but I really encourage parents to get on the American Academy of Pediatrics website, take a look, follow those guidelines, and make an informed decision about your child.
And just on that note, there's this multi-inflammatory syndrome that happens with children, and we've already, CHOC has seen many of those cases. The last time before we were talking about Delta, when I was on a call, there was, over 76 children who were hospitalized with that. So it's not that kids are not getting sick. Kids are getting sick. And, you know, even in the last week, there have been 10 kids who have been hospitalized for COVID, so six who were hospitalized for COVID and four that were hospitalized for suspected COVID, but that's still one too many. You know, kids are our most resilient in our community. They're young, their bodies are young, and so their immune systems are strong. But when even just one child starts getting sick, it's like a canary in a coal mine. It's a bad warning sign to us that the youngest ones are getting sick.
And I do.
Regina, here. Go ahead, Melissa.
I was going to say, I'm concerned we're going to see more and more of it because of the Delta variant. And so I also want to point out that kids can get long haul. So it's not very often, but they can. And so there are some children that are getting long haul and they're having cognitive problems. They're having problems being able to verbalize. And I'm not talking about little kids. I'm talking about teenagers that should be able to verbalize. Particularly younger kids, mothers are reporting that kids are saying, "Mommy, I just don't want to play." So it's going to appear different potentially across lifespan. But if I can say anything that people remember, we don't know what the long-term effects of this virus is on the body. So that means if you contract it, you survive it, or what, long haul or not, we don't know the effect of the virus on this body, on the body. And so even with adults, we don't know if long haul will ever go away. With kids, we don't know if long haul will ever go away. So even though you may not know the effect of the vaccine long haul, the effect of the vaccine in the long term, we don't know the effect of the virus in the long term. So I just want to put that out there for people to really think about.
And to amplify Melissa's point a little bit, we do know, a lot of people think of this as a respiratory illness. Well, it's just because the lungs are so frequently affected. It's actually a vascular illness. It actually causes problems in the blood vessels. So every organ in your body is fed by those blood vessels. So this disease has the potential to affect negatively every organ in the body. So we see people coming in with stroke-like symptoms, heart attack-like symptoms, kidney failure, liver failure, all kinds of problems, blood clots in this center vein of your brain that I haven't seen maybe once my entire career. Now it's something that we keep an eye out for because it happens relatively frequently compared to prior to COVID. So it's a whole new ball game. And as Melissa said, it can really impact, you know, we're only scratching the surface on what this disease is going to do overall to our communities.
And that's part of the reason with long haul, it's been so difficult to characterize. I think I said there's over 200 symptoms. That's probably why, because it gets into nearly every organ in the body system. And so people tend to have differing presentations of not only of COVID, but also of long haul.
Now, again, just to follow up on this, I think one of our questions from the public is, we're 1 week out away from school starting with lots of kids going into classes. What do you tell parents? And again, I guess, you know, we're coming back to this thing, listening to some of this stuff, you're like, how's everything open then if it's this challenging? And I don't know who the best person is to answer that, but what I'm curious is from the question is, what do you tell the parents, you know, who are, I guess, trying to make these calls? Some of them don't have anything other than the local public school to send their kid to. Some people have to do it because of work. I guess, again, we have a lot of questions about what do you tell parents that are gearing up with school and either have vaccinated or unvaccinated kids or potentially both in the same house?
I would say tell the kids to take precaution when they get to school. I mean, we know the damaging effects of, you know, the kids have had to suffer with their education in the last 2 years, right? We know that their grades are failing, the way their performance on a lot of the national school tests are actually reduced significantly because not everybody benefits from doing virtual class. Most kids need that social interaction, need to be around other kids. A lot of learning is the social interaction, and they've been missing out on that for too long. So we do know that when there are mitigation, there's mitigation that's taken in school, we can actually prevent the transmission of the illness. So, you know, the schools will be opening up, and my kids are in school too. And I'm telling my little one who's not vaccinated yet, honey, you have to wear your mask. And yes, maybe you're going to be outdoors. You're not going to want to wear your mask when you're outdoors playing, but I need you to wear your mask. And only when you're eating, you can go ahead and not use your mask. But otherwise, I want him to use his hand sanitizer, his mask. You know, the public overall, all the schools are going to try to get 100% of students back in. And that means they can't do all the distancing. But we know that, again, wearing the mask, everyone wearing a mask actually helps. So this is also why there's a universal masking for the teachers and all the staff at the school.
I was just going to say, we're talking about, that's a vulnerable population, right? The 12 and under that can't get the vaccine. This is the reason why those who can take the precautions and the protection really need to, because as we come around the vulnerable population, we can reduce the spread, but still maintain some normalcy to our life. So we need to get kids back into school. There's so much detriment to not getting them back in. They do have a very low complication rate, but even one, like Regina said, is too many. So I can see why it does make sense from a public policy to send kids back to school, but that really puts the pressure on all of those who can take precautions to do what they can. And it's protecting not just the children, but the vulnerable population that can't get the vaccine, or that even if they do, they're at high risk. And so we just need to take care of them.
Building on that, you know, everybody's kind of wondering where's this thing going from here. And, you know, Vladimir, Sanghak, I wanted to check in with you too. I know it's difficult to, you know, map out any kind of projections as we were talking, you know, because we have, you know, X percent of the population is vaxxed. You know, there's the Delta variant that's kind of running through. But, you know, do you have like a best guess on like, say, where the next 2 or 3 weeks can take us? Are we plateauing? Are we kind of on the decline? Or is it kind of a wait and see approach at this point?
Sanyuk, do you want to go first or do you want to?
I'll let you go ahead with that. I in terms of predicting the future.
Thank you. I guess before I do that, I wanted to say something, which, you know, it's not very comfortable for me as a parent too. But, you know, I hear CDC, California Department of Public Health, every other county health departments repeating the same thing, that we know how to deal with schools during COVID. Which I agree, except with the correction, we used to know how to deal with COVID. We had actually zero experience dealing with Delta in the school environment. So to be honest, we don't know. I know that all the public health officials want to project confidence, and I appreciate that. But the honest answer is we don't know how it's gonna play out, because we're dealing with the highly transmissible variant, which has not circulated during the school year before. So I think we should be open-minded and be prepared to be unpleasantly surprised, because Delta so far did nothing but that. I'm not saying that we should not send kids to school. I'm just saying that I don't like that overconfidence. I feel uneasy about that, that we know how to control transmission in the school environment. I'm not sure about that. In terms of, you know, kind of going into that a little bit, I think the best case scenario that I see is that during the school year, maybe we will see some ease, you know, maybe some reduction of transmission. I see it a little bit right now in the data that we are plateauing in some places. Very timid signs. I wouldn't say we are out of the woods at all. But most likely that's going to change with the school reopenings, and we'll see community transmission increasing. That's my anticipation, because we see it with every respiratory disease. I don't think why Delta variant would be different. And our only hope is to vaccinate more people when the kids below age of 12 become eligible. With the Delta variant, there's no hope of controlling it with vaccination unless we have sterilizing complete immunity of 85-90% of people. And we don't get sterilizing immunity with this amazing vaccine that we have. So it's got to be higher. I mean, you have to add natural immunity. So natural immunity does add to this. So we don't know what vaccination rate will yield the effective protection of the community. But without vaccinating as kids, it's not possible. Like, this is period. Like, we're not going to do anything without, in terms of, you know, driving it down completely without vaccinating kids, all of the kids. Or as much as we can, as many as we can.
Yeah, I'd like to echo what Vladimir said about school transmission. What we're seeing is in places where schools have opened up, you know, in the presence of Delta, they had to actually close down very quick. We've seen that in Mississippi. Just the report that I saw just I believe yesterday was that they reported, just within a week of school opening up, you know, 5 outbreaks at 5 different schools. And so they had to close down and do, you know, go back to remote learning. So this was in a school district in Mississippi. And we're seeing similar, you know, types of scenarios, you know, in a lot of different places as well. Of course, you know, we're not in Mississippi. I think most likely the vaccination rates are higher in most of our school districts. So, you know, that may be something that helps us. But despite that, I do think that we have to be prepared for you know, potentially some unpleasant news, as Vladimir so eloquently said. And I guess going back to what we know helps, I think masking, you know, definitely helps. That said, there are degrees of quality of masks. that, you know, that I think we should consider. So, you know, for example, we know that KN95 masks are masks that are very high quality, and they, you know, they're made to protect against aerosolized transmission. And I think one thing that we could do perhaps better, just from a, you know, public health professional, you know, perspective, is to really promote masks that are high quality. And so I was really pleased to see that in Oklahoma, Utah, that the governor mandated, you know, sending out KN95 masks to all children so that they can be protected as schools open up. So I think there are, you know, vaccines, I think we've been focusing on vaccines, which, you know, of course we should, but there are other strategies I think that can add additional benefit. So high quality masks, ventilation. So I think that ventilation is one area that has not been a huge focus because, you know, because it costs money to make, typically to make improvements in ventilations of schools. So I'm not sure the extent to which in Orange County, our schools have been assessed and evaluated for ventilation and how we can improve, you know, ventilation at schools, but there's pretty strong evidence that suggests that improving that kind of, you know, adding just opening windows and adding higher or stronger ventilation systems within schools, you know, led to up to 50% reduction in cases, you know, and this was a study that done in Georgia. So I think there are multiple tools that we perhaps haven't taken full advantage of, you know, as we're rolling out these vaccines, you know, our vaccination rates are still not at the level. And I think that, you know, we can kind of boost the overall population level effect by pushing forward additional strategies.
You've mentioned again outside a couple of times. I remember when this first started, you know, we were generally told, you know, if you're outside at a protest, at the beach, at a park, you're generally fine. You don't have to wear the mask. Is that still the same now, or was Delta changed that?
I think it's most likely still the same. You know, it's, you know, because we can't actually see the virus transmit, so it's impossible to be 100% sure. But just from everything that we know, the risk is, you know, should be very low outdoors. That said, a lot of these massive outdoors events, you know, people don't just stay outdoors. I think there's a lot of indoor gatherings that occur that's attached to that. So I think that's where the you know, concern is with elevated risk. But just kind of being outdoors, enjoying the beach, that is likely very, very, very low risk.
Jim, one question I have that we get a lot from different readers is these different alternative treatments for COVID. You know, we've heard this I can't even pronounce it, but you know the thing I'm talking about. I had another one here from a reader, fenofibrate. Can you say anything, or any of you, can you speak to some of these, you know, alternative treatments? Are they any good or not?
Sure. So, I mean, what you're looking for is a game changer, right? You're not looking for something that reduces your chance by 1% or 2% of having a bad outcome. You're not looking for something that's going to just reduce your chance by 10% of getting COVID to begin with. So it's hard to really speak to that because, yes, there is some evidence that if you have a vitamin D deficiency, if you're not doing well in your nutrition or other things, you're, of course, more susceptible to a lot of different illnesses, not just COVID. So good health overall is always a good thing. There is, for example, the Math Plus protocol. People can look that up online. That's been touted and studied, and a lot of people are using that. There's a lot of, you'll see that there's a lot of multivitamins in there and other things that can be given. There's methylprednisolone, which is a steroid once you get it, that actually does seem to improve people quite a bit. I think the data on a lot of the antibiotics in general is kind of iffy. Maybe it adds some benefit, but not enough to pound the table and say it's going to really change the course of this disease for the majority of the population. It's certainly not something where I see people saying, well, I don't want to get vaccinated, and when I do, I'll just take some hydroxychloroquine and vitamin D and some steroids and I'll be fine. That's not how this works. It's not going to change the course of the disease so dramatically that it has not been, those things, like, let's just say those things have not been shown to reduce hospitalization or death. to any significant extent. And that's, at this point, that's, at least from my perspective, that's what we're looking at, is how do we reduce those?
Yeah, I love the question. Yes, I get this question all the time. And I think just like with anything, with any acute illness or chronic illness, we need to take a nice, good approach with everything that we do, from getting good sleep, getting adequate rest, because that actually helps boost our immune system, eating the right foods, the healthy foods that are going to help restore our gut and give us the right nutrients that maybe we're deficient in, or maybe we're not as high as we need to be. Because when you get sick or when you get exposed to COVID, you want your defenses to be at their best. And so everything does help, but I agree with what Dr. Keeney said. If something that you're looking into is only going to give you 1% improvement, it's, and not the 95% effectiveness that the vaccine is going to give, you can't put all your eggs in one basket to that one thing. You have to, again, take the full approach to protect yourselves and your family.
What about another question we have is mixing vaccinated and unvaccinated people. If you're vaccinated, do you need to worry about going into a crowd where you're going to be around? Let's say you have family members that are not vaccinated. You're going to go to a family event. Does it matter?
Yes, it does. I think when you're vaccinated, you're less likely to get ill with COVID, but there's still a chance that you can get it. There was a new study that was actually published in MMWR showing that in Kentucky, they looked at vaccinated, unvaccinated. They found that those who were unvaccinated had a 2.34 times likely to get COVID. We are still seeing the breakthroughs, however. And again, if you're vaccinated, you get exposed and you actually carry COVID, you may not have symptoms, or you may have mild symptoms. And if you're carrying it, you can actually transmit it to others.
Are you all at the county connecting with the school districts as they put together their protocols? And one of the things that I'm hearing from all of you is that this kind of just keeps changing, and it keeps changing. And yet it seems, you know, our entire reopening seems, again, from listening to you all, is based on, you know, potentially dated information now. How are you dealing with all of the school districts? Do they come to you for advice? Does it go the other way?
Yes, usually the schools are meeting with us at least once a week. We have, and for the most part, yes, over the last week when we last met, we were talking about the K-12 guidance that was put out by the California Department of Public Health. But, you know, as the information changes, I'm sure that California Department of Health will also look into changing the recommendations. But again, we're trying to be in alignment with the state, so the message is all the same.
You know, I think one of the things I'm going to ask everybody, if there's anything that you feel like we should be including at this point. We try to keep these panels to about an hour. We're totally open to coming back. I think that in some cases, these are good reunions to get together and get what we can kind of discuss in a certain digestible manner, and then keep updating since the situation keeps changing. Is there anything that any of you would want to add before we ended today?
Yeah, I'd like to add one thing about you know, just kind of thinking about the situation that we're in right now, when we have what, like 60% of our community vaccinated, and we're still seeing this exponential increase in cases and hospitalizations and deaths. And so one thing to think about is, you know, how bad or how horrific things would have been if we did not have vaccines. And it would have been absolutely horrible. But this is, in fact, the exact situation that a lot of the world is in right now, is that they're seeing this Delta devastating their communities without any access to vaccines. So, you know, for example, Africa as a continent, you know, so this is where I do a lot of my research. There's, you know, the current vaccination coverage is 2%. So 2% of Africans are protected against the vaccine. And so we're seeing these catastrophic increases in lots of these countries. So I think, I know that we want to focus on kind of local situation, but it's absolutely vital because, you know, a Delta variant, I think as far as we know, it came from, originally it was detected in India, right? So, and then it spread all over the world. And so what's the next vaccine that's going to, next variant that's going to arise that is perhaps even more transmissible or more deadly than the horrible Delta variant that we're struggling with right now? And that, you know, we're kind of setting the stage right now somewhere in the world for another, you know, variant to arise. And so I think it's absolutely vital that all of us pressure our policymakers and the vaccine manufacturers to make sure that vaccines are the supply is increased, that there's equitable access to vaccines across the world, because it already has affected us, and it will definitely affect us the more we sort of hoard the vaccines and just think about, you know, just kind of narrowly think about just how we're doing.
Well said, Sonia.
I would like to add something for long haulers. Yeah. So long haulers feel very forgotten. And right now they're really struggling and there's a lot of suffering. Not only have they had COVID, not only do they have a disease that they don't know what the outcome is going to be, they don't know what the trajectory is, but sometimes they've not been listened to by providers. And so I'm speaking to them now, saying that we hear you, we see you. I want to tell you about a resource that you may want to go to get some support. It's called Survivor Corps. It's on Facebook. There's over 170,000 people that are a member of Survivor Corps, but there are scientists interacting with patients. Also, I want to say that this affects mood. And so if you're having any sort of issues with your mood or cognition, I want you to know that is something that we're seeing, and to encourage people to seek help. But just know that people are really suffering from long COVID. And I know myself and our team are working on it, but want to make sure that you know the resources that you can access for long COVID, because a lot of times the conversation is on the acute illness.
Wow, that's a great point, Melissa. And it's something that we as a newsroom will stay connected with you on, because it is a really important aspect of this, that it's, you know, there's an adventure that begins when you get out of the emergency room. Well, you're saying.
There was a high, the woman that writes for Dawson's Creek died by suicide because she had long COVID. The person that owned Texas Roadhouse had ringing in the ears, long COVID, feel like loss of hope, died by suicide. So I want to speak to these people that are survivors with long COVID, because I think sometimes they feel lost and forgotten and are really struggling because there is no treatment or cure for them.
Great points. I mean, a great point and probably a great way to at least end this, you know, discussion. And again, I can't thank all of you enough for making time out for what are already long days. You know, we've learned so much throughout this whole year about what many of you do in the medical field, that a lot of times public health departments are not things that we're talking about in news on such a constant basis. So again, it's really appreciated all of you taking the time out. Readers, listeners, same thing. Thank you so much for dialing in. We hope that this is of use to you. Feel free to send us your comments. Tell us where we met the mark. Tell us what else you want to see. We will stay in touch here. This newsroom, this nonprofit news is here for you. Last point that supporters always want me to remind is that, remember, all of this is free to you. All of our stories, all the information, all the podcasts, it's not free to produce. So wherever you can, feel free to contribute whatever you can. Every little bit helps to keep us having this kind of an independent newsroom that can stay on top of government and other leaders, and at least try to get you the information that you can utilize to protect you and your family and protect your quality of life as best you can. So again, we're here for you. Thanks again to the panel and to the readers for joining us and for the questions. We had so many come through. They were so thoughtful. And again, we will continue to do these. Just let us know your thoughts and feedback again. See you soon then. Thanks again, everybody. Stay safe out there.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Thanks.